Thank you, Billy, and for having me. This is a tremendous honor, and what a year, what a year. Happy New Year to everybody at this meeting. And I always get a little emotional. I see some friendly faces, and it just popped on, and it's this is a beautiful thing. You know, if you're new, welcome. If you've got some time, it's good to see you, and you're a real inspiration to me. My sobriety date is April 27th, 2002. And for a Irish Puerto Rican donkey from Chicago, a real big dum-dum, that amount of time is miraculous. I mean, how do you stay sober for 30 days? I mean, the first week you're killing it. You're just like, look at me. I mean, was drinking even a problem? And then you're 2 weeks in and you're like, this is amazing. 3 weeks, you're coming in on the 30 days. In 30 days, you're like, there's no better way to celebrate a month sober than with a drink. I mean, how do you do this? I have to be really honest. I do want to welcome the newcomers, and I want to say, you know, Bob D is one of my favorite speakers, and he says something that I really love, which is, you know, this, I want to share my story, obviously, with my people here, a fellow group of drunks. But also to the, you know, if you're drunk or high right now and you're on this Zoom, I really genuinely want to welcome you. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. If you've got some time, and you've been a little bit away from the work and the Zoom's weighing heavy on your heart, and you got one foot out the door and maybe you don't even know it, and you're a little closer to a drink than you are to your recovery, I hope that you reach out to somebody after this meeting and you let them know what's going on with you, and know that you're loved. I am a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'll be totally honest, all my cards on the table here, because I cannot stop drinking. Like I on my own, like I can't do it. And it, man, it almost killed me. I mean, I need you guys. I need Alcoholics Anonymous. I need the meetings. I need the steps, but I didn't know any of this. Like it's been a rough year. This is a miracle. This meeting right now, New Year's Eve, we're all here on this together, and there's hope and there's community. And the odds are we're all going to hit the pillow sober tonight. That is, I never, ever want to lose sight of how miraculous that was. I mean, you know how hard it was buying drugs when your face looks like you're a detective from the 30s? I mean, look at this. You know, I you know how many times I had to say, I'm not a cop. I will do the drugs with you. I mean, look at this face. I'm Irish and Puerto Rican. If being alcoholic wasn't bad enough, being Irish and Puerto Rican is like being on both sides in the musical West Side Story, with all the fighting and the singing and the dancing, minus the singing and dancing. I mean, I grew up in Chicago. My parents were teenagers. They were riddled with alcoholism and mental health issues. My uncle was killed when he was four, or when I was four, he was in his 20s. My dad died when he was 23. I was seven. A direct result of his alcoholism. His girlfriend, who was a junkie, found out that she was pregnant with his child the day that she also found out that he was in the morgue. And he was in the morgue for 3 days under the name John Doe because his corpse was robbed and he had no identification on it. That was his story. That's what his alcoholism did to him. Alcoholism destroyed my mother's life. She lost custody of me at 14. Her alcoholism led her into a life of prostitution and then eventually a felony conviction for bank robbery. And I'll tell you, as a kid, being around violence and abuse and seeing the alcohol going around, I made a decision fairly early on that was not going to happen to me. That I'm just not going to drink like that. I'm not going to do drugs. And when it became my time and I drank, which is, you know, to give you the, I want to give you a little scope of the beauty of what Alcoholics Anonymous has done in my life. So I'm going to do like a little before and an after. So what I say might sound a little harsh, but then we'll bring the recovery in, which is my mother used to take me out drinking with her when I was, like 9 and 10. So she would like wake me up at midnight and say, "We're going dancing, wear something sexy." So, okay. So I get like my corduroy pants and my mustard yellow Catholic schoolboy uniform shirt on, you know, something sexy. We go to the nightclub and I'd be drinking Manhattans, the smoke machine going on. And I get home at 2 or 3. Sometimes I'd drive home because she was too drunk. It's at 9 or 10 in Chicago. I go to school the next day and the nuns be like, "Today we're going to learn about fractions." And I'm like, "I got home an hour ago. Like, how important is this really? My head's killing me. When are we eating the snacks?" Like, it all, I would go to church and you know, there'd be a guy with nails in his hands and feet. And I'm like, "Oh my God, what happened to that guy?" And the guy selling the newspapers would be like, "They killed him." And I'm like, "Who killed him?" And he goes, "The Italians." So this is the world in which I was raised. I mean, my grandmother said, you gotta be an altar boy if you're gonna, I mean, you are done. And you know, that time in the religion that I was brought up in, like, if you thought it, you did it. Like, it was a sin if you even thought it. We were in sixth grade and me and my group of friends that I'm still friends with now, we had a meeting behind the church and we said, "Are we all hearing the same thing? Like, if we think this, that we're doing it?" And they're like, "Yeah, yeah." I'm like, "We got to start doing it because we're getting hit either way. I mean, if we're taking a case either way, we cannot just be thinking this. We got to be doing it." And then everyone was like, "Yeah, that makes sense." So we turned into like a pack of ravenous gypsies. If it wasn't nailed down, we stole it. And all the abuse that was happening during the week, we go to church on the weekend. I'm like, "Where's this guy Monday through Saturday? Like, what's going on?" So I had this dysfunctional relationship with my family and then with the idea of God in the church that I went to, that I was an altar boy at, the worst altar boy in the history of altar boys. I'm bringing the cross out when he's doing the homily and he's like, "Go back in the sacristy," stealing bags of Eucharists, bags of hosts. I remember one time our priest, Father Sketch, says, "Go get some hosts and put them in the sacristy, the Eucharist." And I go, so I'm looking at how to get up on the roof. And he goes, "What are you doing?" I go, "I got to go. Don't the angels bring the hosts in the roof?" And he goes, "They're in the storage closet." So I'm like, "What?" Like, I couldn't get my head around. So I go in the storage closet and I open a corrugated box. There's a bag of vacuum sealed hosts with a shipping label from Cleveland. And I'm like, "There's a guy in Cleveland making the body of Christ? Like, he's just on an assembly line, just banging them out and throwing him in the bag, and he's got to tell us, like, 'Frank, what do you do for a living?' 'Well, you know, I'm over at the Body of Christ factory. It's pretty $13.50 an hour, but good benefits. It's all right. You know, they give you something to take home for Thanksgiving and Christmas. It's all right." Like, I couldn't. It was like in The Wizard of Oz when, like, you start to see behind. You're like, "What? The priest smokes, and he swears about the Cubs. What is happening?" In the name of my church was St. Odilo. If you don't know who St. Odilo is, you're in a perfect spot because no one does. St. Odilo is the patron saint of purgatory. I went to the school of meh. Like, that was my church. Meh. Like, you're not good. You meh. You're just kind of bleh. Like, this. The whole thing. It's like, "Oh my God, the patron saint of purgatory." And then we started drinking. And I got to tell you, like, I'm going to spend a whole lot of time on the drunkalogue, but man, it worked like nothing I had ever experienced in my entire life. This is around 13, 14. And I didn't have bruises. I wasn't hungry. I didn't feel hopeless. I wasn't scared. The only way that I've ever tangibly been able to define alcohol, the relationship that I had to alcohol and what alcohol did to and for me is this. This is what alcohol did for me. It gave me infinite hope and possibility for me. Yes, it made me drunk. Ooh, a big benefit. But when I drank, I really felt like I could do or be anything. And man, that's a hard thing not to engage in. That's a hard thing not to indulge in. That's a hard thing not to consume when it makes you feel like that. And it worked till I was about 18. And there's no dumber animal on earth than an 18-year-old guy. When I was 18, I almost joined the Marines twice to get a sword. Yeah, that was me firing on all cylinders there. What, 4 years of my life for a sword and I get to fight dragons? Sign me up. And somehow I caught this last minute scholarship to college. And I went totally off my rocker and drank like a lunatic, lost a scholarship, got kicked out of two or three dormitories. And now I was just a young guy with a sad story. There was a bunch of other stuff. My mom lost custody of me. I lived alone without parents when I was 13 and 14. None of that makes me an alcoholic. It's sad. Gave me PTSD, but it didn't give me alcoholism. And when I drank, I felt amazing. And like we've heard a million times at meetings, it was fun. It was fun with problems. And then it was nothing but problems. And I didn't know what Alcoholics Anonymous was. And I knew that I had a problem drinking. I knew that drinking had destroyed my entire family. And I knew what the solution was. I'm going to stop drinking. Very simple. Very simple. And then all of a sudden I couldn't. And another thing was happening and I had no idea what this was because I had no idea what alcoholism was. I thought everything had to do with alcohol, but I had no idea what alcoholism was. I also have this voice in my head. I don't know if anybody else has it. I'm guessing you do if you're an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that voice, which is my drinking partner, recommends all kinds of insane ideas at all times. Now, before I came into AA, I had no regulator for that voice. That voice would say something and I'd say, go on. And then I would just do whatever the voice said. So when I was 18, I was bouncing some party in some rich neighborhood and it was late and, my loving advance was scorned by some rich woman and she stormed out and I jumped on my chopper motorcycle and I was roaring up and down the street. And, finally I see a police officer who's going, you know, like this, like shut the bike off. So I shut the bike off and I go, oh, is there a problem here, officer? And he goes, well, I tell you what, I'm going to list a couple of things. And then you tell me as I list some things, if you see a problem here like I do. And I thought, wow, look at this fair guy. Yeah, let's do that. And he goes, well, I was trying to run your license plate while you were ripping up and down the block here. And there's no license plate on your vehicle. And I was going to ask you for your license and registration, but I see that you're the only piece of clothing that you have on is underpants. And I can smell the alcohol on you from here, and I'm about 10 feet away from you. Do you want me to keep going? And I'm like, no, I think you've established some fairly valid points. And he moves closer to me, and he goes, clearly, you are not from here. And I go, yeah, I'm from Chicago, and I'm out here doing security a little thing. He goes, I'm from Chicago. F these rich people. And I go, exactly. You get what I'm saying here. And he goes, well, it's hard to also overlook what's going on because you're going the one you're going the wrong way on a one-way street, on the sidewalk. So there's multiple things here that are stacking up. But I'll tell you what, it's late. I don't want to do the paperwork. Tell me it's insured, and I will let you push it back down the block to whence you came. Sane person would see this great gift and say, thank you, officer. I'm incredibly sorry. It is insured, and I will go now. But what the voice in my head said was this. Touch his mustache. And I was like, what's that voice in my head? Did I just hear you right? What did you just say? And the voice in my head said, touch his mustache. He's gonna love it. So I said, all right, voice in my head, when have you ever let me down? And so I just reached out and I said, chocolate rainbow. And I don't know if anybody on this Zoom meeting has ever spontaneously run their finger through a police officer's mustache without their consent. But there's a weird moment where you pull your finger back and both men are staring at each other like, did you just run your finger through my mustache? And then for me, what happens is everything goes black. And then I wake up chained to a stainless steel table with painted cinder blocks, and I turn around and see bars, because apparently for that man, his response was very physical to my very kind gesture. I didn't know about the first step. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol and that our lives had become unmanageable. Yes, alcohol. But this unmanageability is obtuse. It's surreal. I can't get my head around it because alcohol is so loud and it's tangible. I drink and then things get crazy. But this unmanageability is off my radar. I'm drinking at a jazz place called the Green Mill in Chicago on Broadway and Lawrence. Story joint, 4 a.m. during the week, 5 on Saturday. Cold Schlitz on tap, baby grand piano behind the bar. And I'm being loud and a jazz trio is playing. And I'm just being loud. I'm not even talking to anybody. I'm just being a grade A alcoholic asshole. And the guy next to me elbows me and he goes, hey, man, you know, this jazz band's phenomenal, man. Can you just pipe it down a little bit? And I said, Is that how you talk to the number one jazz studio trumpet player in the world? And he goes, come on, man. I'm just trying to watch the band. You're being loud. And you just got to pipe it down. And I go, I don't have to do anything. Because now you have to ask yourself, are you the guy that wants to get his ass kicked by the number one jazz studio trumpet player in the world? And then the bouncer grabs me by the lapel and he's dragging me out. I'm trying to kick the guy and the band stopped and I get tossed out like a cartoon character out into the street. Now, an important piece of information regarding the story is I don't play the trumpet. I don't know how to read music. I like jazz. I couldn't name three jazz musicians if you had a gun to my head. And I share that story because I had to believe the lie. I had to believe the lie. I was going to fight for the lie. I was going to defend the lie with violence and total insanity. Or, as the big book says, unmanageability. So I have jobs and I'm losing jobs and I'm going out on runs and it's getting worse. And I'm trying to stop now. And I'm so ashamed that I can't even stop my hands from picking up alcohol. Cause everyone that loves me is like, you gotta stop drinking, man. You might be an alcoholic. And some are like, you are an alcoholic. I remember I saw some great, therapist in Chicago that a friend had to call to get to the thing and she can see you, but you gotta go there right now. So I went and I told her my story and she goes, you're an alcoholic. And I go, you're an angel. That's what you are. Truth teller telling me the truth. And she goes, I can get you into a 2-week inpatient rehab right now. We get in the car and we go, and I go, you know, I'm in. Let's God sent you to me. I'm going to duck out real quick. I'm going to go in the parking lot and have a cigarette, and then I'm going to come back in here, you big angel, and then we're going to get in your car and go to that rehab. And I'm sure everybody on this Zoom knows how that cigarette break took about 6 more years. I never went back in. I was like, nope, not going to happen. And why can't I stop drinking? Like, why can't I stop drinking? You got to stop drinking. I watched drugs and alcohol destroy my family. I drove through Greektown in Chicago, and there was a table, summer, Greek guys, shirts open, bushy, hairy chests, gold chains, big, thick mustaches, black hair coiffed back at these tables, sunlight hitting them, bottle of ouzo on the table, and these little tiny glasses. And I thought, bang, I gotta get smaller glasses. Oh my God, it's been in front of me this whole time. So I go to Pier 1 and I get tiny glasses and a bottle of ouzo to honor my fellow Greek problem solvers. And I go back to my apartment and I go in and I tell my wife, honey, the nightmare is over. Problem solved. Look. And she goes, there's alcohol in your hand. And I go, yeah, don't look at this. Yes. This has alcohol in it, but look at these two glasses. And she's like, well, what are you going to put in the glasses? And I go, technically alcohol. But you're not looking at the glasses. She goes, but are you going to drink? And I go, well, yeah, but the glasses, you know what? You don't understand what I'm trying to do here. And she stormed out and I poured a glass of ouzo, had a second one. Then the pint glass came out. Then that glass went away. And why can't I stop drinking? And it got to the point where in order for me to go out drinking, it was 3 days. And, you know, I'd get home, I'd charge the phone that had died 12 hours into the day one of the run. And I'd hear a woman who I loved and adored shaking and sobbing, asking me to please just call her and let her know that I'm alive. And that's what I did to my wife. That's who I am when I drink. When I'm fully insane and untreated alcoholism. And so I got to get sober. What am I going to do? My way doesn't work. So on April 21st, 2001, I picked up the phone and I dialed 411, which for anybody under 35, that's like Google with a human being. 411 information. How can I help you? And I go, well, I don't know how to stay sober, and drugs and alcohol killed my mother and my father and my uncle, and my wife's going to leave me, and I'm going to lose my job. And she said, that's very tragic, sir. Can I help you find a business? So I go, oh yeah. Who would you recommend to help me stop drinking? And she said, I think you're looking for Alcoholics Anonymous. I can give you their number. So I called Alcoholics Anonymous, and this is what happened. I'm terrified. I don't know what to do. I don't know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous. I saw it once on Taxi, the show Taxi, where a guy had to say that who his name was and that he was an alcoholic. And they said, Alcoholics Anonymous, how can we help? And that was the first miracle. In Alcoholics Anonymous for me. That was the first time that I experienced a miracle, because I found out later that that's a commitment, and that that person isn't paid to pick up that phone, but that person sits in front of that phone and waits for somebody that might need help, that may have a desire to stop drinking. And I said, listen, I'm going to die. And I don't want to die. What do I do? And she says, where are you at right now? And I told her my address, and she goes, you're going to go to a place called the Four Nickels. It's 5555 North Lincoln. It's an Alano club in Chicago. You need to go over there right now. So I said, okay. And now here's some weird miracles that are happening. I'm saying, yes, I'm not distrustful. Why would I do that? Okay, there's a little desperation going on here. So I get there and I park the car, and to the right is the Apache Motel. I don't need to tell anybody that is an alcoholic or has dabbled in drugs. No one ever leaves the Apache Motel after 3 days and goes, well, that was great. That was awesome. Like, no. Sight of the last run. Mystery. Intimidating, terrifying mystery in front of me that might take away my best friend, drinking. And I go in anyway. And I go in, and it's a tiny room, and there's a little table, and there's four people in there, and it's this woman with a mullet and a softball jersey, and she's holding a binder. Then there's a young kid in there. Actually, there were three people. I was the fourth. There was an older guy in there with a mouth that used to have teeth, but one stayed, and that one looked like it was getting ready to go. And I'm terrified, and I'm humming. And they start the meeting, and they say, is anybody here new or in their first 30 days of sobriety? And I said, my name is Mick, and I'm an alcoholic, and I lost it. I just started sobbing and going into my story and every awful thing that had ever happened to me or that I'd done or thought or wanted to be. And then 20 minutes later, I stop, and I'm panting and looking around the room. There's this awkward pause, and then without missing a beat, the woman with the binder goes, okay, and now our speaker will speak. And then AA just happened. Like, the meeting happened. They didn't kick me out. They didn't go, you dumb. They just, it happened. And there was a format, and there was structure. And sound was like going in and out, and I'm sweating, and I'm starting to get angry. I'm like, what about the sad crying guy? Look at all of my emotions here. Can we change what you do here for once? I am in pain. I am bringing you pain here. And I opened up to you strangers about some things here. And I think maybe we should hit the pause button on what you normally do so we could deal with this. No, just it kept going. And sound was going. And now I'm nervous. And I start looking around the room, and I see a placard. There's 12 of them lined up. And it says, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol and that our lives had become unmanageable. And I was like, never heard that before. I'm like, yes, that makes a lot of sense. And then the next one said, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And I was like, power? What? Like a kind of power? Like a wizard? And then the third one said, we admitted we've made a decision to turn our life and our will over to the care of God. And before I could read the rest, my butthole just went just whoosh, just whoosh, like, what? No. And then like icicles on me. I'm like, no, this is a God thing. I knew it. Why didn't I? Normally I could see these things. Like, I just flashed forward to like 6 months later, finally winning my purple sash robe so that I can hand out the blue flowers at the airport while I'm banging the tambourine to get everyone to come to the tent spaceship. Ooh, like, oh my God, how am I going to get out of here? So I'm starting to freak out. And then without warning or notice, the guy next to me just starts rubbing my back. And I'm like, oh my God, what is this? And he's getting in the neck, and I'm like, in what world do you just massage strangers? We're not on ecstasy here. This is totally inappropriate. Lines are being crossed. All you got to do is ask. I couldn't believe it. And then he goes, you know what you need? And I'm like, no, but I bet you're going to tell me. And he's like, you need a book. And I'm like, that's what I was just thinking. I need a book. We have a book around here. And I'm like, oh, I can't wait to read it. And he goes, I'm going to give you a book. And I'm like, you're the best. You're the best guy. I'm going to read your book. And then he put his number in, and he's like, you call me 24/7. I'm like, I'm calling you 24/7. You're like a big fat angel. And he gave me the book. And then I sat there terrified, and then just like the teacher in Peanuts. Wah, 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 wah. Well, how am I going to get out of here? I'm nodding. And then the worst thing that can happen to an alcoholic like me is I start feeling a little relief. Like I dumped a big bag of rocks on the meeting and I can just back out of here because now I'm feeling okay and things are all right. Maybe it was a bad run. Maybe it was bad. I can figure this out. I'll read this book, but I'm not coming back here and I'm not dealing with any of these people. So that's what I did. I read the book. They said, you read the first 164 pages. I go, I'm going to do it. And I read it like a defense lawyer trying to get his client off a murder beef. I was flipping through that thing like whiskey and milk. I got to try that. And I would go to meetings Monday through Thursday, sit in the back, share sometimes because, you know, you got it when you're still drinking. Sharing's a great idea. I'm sharing. And then I go out and I drink Friday to Sunday. And I'm dying. And as all of this is going on, I remembered something that the woman with the binder said at my very first meeting. If you are a real alcoholic and you continue to drink, you will experience what is called pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. And I had never heard that combination of words before. And no one ever said anything to me at these meetings. Of course everybody knew that I was drunk. Of course everybody knew that I was still drinking. But hey, keep coming back. Keep coming back. And so I kept coming back because I couldn't stop drinking on my own. And I couldn't face the insanity of my alcoholism on my own. And then I found myself in California. Moved from Chicago almost a year to the day later, and I'm standing on Skid Row, which is significant. It's significant anywhere, but in California and particularly in Los Angeles, it's very tragic. And I remember scanning the block filled with boxes and people staggering down the street like zombies. And I thought, these people got it made. If all I had to do was just wake up and figure out how to drink, and that's all I had to do, I've won. And that's with people who love me and a wife in an apartment 10 miles north of where I was. And that was a moment of clarity. Did I just try to talk myself into living in a box with the sole objective in my life to drink? And I did. And so I went to a place called Radford Hall in Studio City, California, and I went to the podium there during the 6 p.m. meeting, and I said, my name's Mick. I'm an alcoholic. I've been trying to do this my way for about a year, and I haven't been able to stop drinking, and I feel like I'm about to die, and I have like a little light left in me, and if it goes out, I don't feel like there's a point of a return for me, and I don't know what to do. And as I was walking off the podium, the woman sitting right in the front row said, hey, go ask the guy making coffee to be your sponsor. And here's probably the most significant miracle, sustaining miracle that's happened to me in my sobriety. I said, okay. And I didn't say, who are you? Who's the guy making the coffee? I didn't hold on to that relief of just getting that off my chest. And now I'm going to sit in the back and just ride this bad patch out. I went to the guy making coffee and I said, hey, this woman in the other room says I should ask you to be my sponsor. And he goes, okay, when this meeting's over, because I have the coffee commitment, we're gonna go we'll go down the block and we'll get some coffee. And I go, well, there's coffee right behind you. And he goes, I don't co-sign bullshit, kid. If you want to get sober, I'm your guy. If you're willing to take direction, I'm your guy. I don't want to be your friend. I got plenty of friends. If you're interested in staying sober a day at a time, I can take you through the steps. I can tell you what I did to stay sober. I don't want to see you die. If you don't want to see yourself die, let's go get coffee after the meeting. What do you say? And I was like, oh, wait a second. Like, I can't manipulate this guy. Like, I can't work this guy. We can't be pals. Can't I just put up one hand in your pocket and another hand over your shoulder here? What? Why can't I do that? And he's like, no. And we went. And I told him a little bit about my story. And he said, here's what I want you to do. I want you to do 90 meetings in 90 days. I want you to call me every day at 6 a.m. I'm going to take you through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and then immediately you're going to start taking other men through the 12 steps. But before we get through the steps, if there's any commitments that you can take, I want you to take them. Anything. Your hand goes up. We need this. Your hand goes up. And I said, that's all. That's great, man. I get to bed around 2 or 3 a.m. So I'd like to, you know, what can we do about that 6 a.m. call-in time? And he goes, well, it sounds like it's going to be very difficult for you. What? Like, didn't you just, things shouldn't be difficult for me, really. I mean, we should not have to say that, but like, can't you change the time? Like, you know, and respect this, the time that I go to bed. And he goes, 6 a.m. That's when you got to call me. So I was like, okay. And I did it. And I called at 6 a.m. And this is how it went. Hey, Steve, I don't know if you remember me. It's Mick. We went to coffee at Lulu's Beehive. I remember who you are. Yes. I'm just calling to check in. How you doing? He goes, I'm great, kid. How you doing? And I go, I'm great, man. How you doing? He goes, I'm great. More importantly, how are you doing? And I go, I'm great. How are you doing? He goes, I think we've covered that. You're good? I'm great. Great. Call me tomorrow at 6. Okay. Call him again. And now I'm going to all these meetings, right? And I'm calling Steve every day, 6 a.m., 6 a.m. Now I'm going to these meetings and I'm hearing guys talk. Women talk. Guys talking. They're going on hikes with their sponsor. They're using terms like spiritual advisor, father figure, mother figure. And I'm like, what's happening with Steve? Like, pulled a shit sponsor straw here? Like, what is happening here? So all this is going, I'm calling Steve every day at 6. Hey, Steve, how you doing? I'm good, kid. How you doing? I'm good, man. How you doing? I'm great. More importantly, how you doing? I'm good. Great. Call me tomorrow. What? So finally I call him and I go, listen, it's at the noon meeting. Ted's working out with his sponsor. They're going to a movie later tonight. And this other guy's going to Malibu. They're hiking. What's up with you, man? What's this weird Mr. Miyagi shit you're doing with me as a fine, you call me fine, yes, good, yes. What is this? And he goes, well, what are you talking about? And I go, every time I call you, I ask you how you're doing. And you're like, fine. And he goes, well, how you doing? And I go, I'm awful, man. Like, they're coming to repossess our Hyundai, and it probably costs more in gas to drive to get the Hyundai than the Hyundai's actually worth. So I have to park it 2 miles from the house so the repo man can't hook it. And there's an eviction notice on our apartment and my son's on the way and I have no job and I'm broke. And my downstairs neighbor keeps smirking at me through the window like he knows what's going on. And I think I'm going to stab him. That's what's going on. And he's like, oh, do you know what just happened right there? And I go, what? And he goes, you did a little something called getting honest. And it floored me. It was like someone kicked me in the chest, because up until that, my whole life, and I can justify it a myriad of ways, my survival instincts merged with my alcoholism. Who cares? It's like alcohol. It had stopped working. And it was so embarrassing to me that I didn't know how to have a genuine conversation with another human being without motive, without moving pieces and setting things up. And he goes, it's scary. It's like, I'm terrified, man. He goes, yeah, that's the second half of the first step. You want to know why you drank? Quit drinking. And then everything that you drank over is going to be staring at you right in the face. And I go, I'm terrified, man. What is this? And he goes, it's alcoholism. And if it's not alcoholism, then what is it? He goes, stay sober long enough to find out. And so I did. And he took me through the steps and I had commitments and we did the inventory and I left something off. We went to this beautiful place. There were trees. There were little white dots sprinkled through the green coniferous trees, bald eagles. And I said, I'm going to the grave with something. I'm not going to tell this guy. And I'm sober and, I got a sober secret and it's eaten me up. I never had one before. and I don't like the way it makes me feel. It makes me feel disconnected from the group. It makes me feel disconnected from the idea, from the promise of Alcoholics Anonymous. But I've turned my back on that. So I call him 2 weeks later. I say, hey, Steve, I left something off that four step. And he goes, okay, you're not the first. You won't be the last. What is it? And I go, what are you talking about? He goes, tell me. And I go, you wait, on the phone? He goes, yeah, tell me right now. Tell me on the phone. And I go, can we go back for the trees with the eagles? And we'll sit and we'll hold hands and do the third step prayer. He goes, kid, just fucking tell me what the thing is. And I'm like, all right. And I told him, and I was free of that. And I was free of that. I was a part of Alcoholics Anonymous, flawed, seven-step prayer. My creator, I'm now willing that you should have all of me, good and bad. And that inventory was a big deal for a dum-dum like me, because first on my resentment list, God. Second on my resentment list, rich people. These are the big seething in my heart. Get it out. So what do I do with that? How can I be a part of a program that God is all over? It's one of the reasons why I cut and ran from the very first meeting that I went to. And there's this beautiful thing in the big book. I'll just read a little bit of it if you'll, I don't have to read it. Basically, it says this. This step will have little permanent effect unless immediately followed by a rigorous course of action to face and get rid of the things that had been blocking us. Alcohol was but a symptom. And so I would have to go on trust and faith to believe that it's, and there's a beautiful line in the book where it says, God either is or isn't. What is our choice to be? So I said, God is. I barely made it out of high school. I can't, you know, a guy one time brought me to the ocean and he said, who made all of this? And I said, Jesus, man, you got to lower the bar. I mean, you want me to tell you who created the ocean? Come on, man. I got a D in chemistry because I befriended the teacher's kid. Like, I can't, what are you, insane? Like, I cannot put the weight of the riddle of the human experience and the cosmos on my shoulders in order to stay sober. God is. Now what? Face and get rid of the things that have been blocking me. And so I did that. I did that inventory work. And I did the seven step, and I had this like a Netflix queue of shameful memories. So in sobriety, every time I'm feeling good and all of a sudden want to watch this. Remember when you did this, you giant piece of garbage? No. How about this? Remember the time you did this? Just this constant onslaught. How do I stop this? Well, I make a list of the people that I've harmed, and then I become willing to make amends. And so my sponsor said, listen, when you go to make amends, no recounting the story, no saying you're a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, none of that manipulative garbage. You say one of two things. I was wrong. How can I make it right? Or you say, I want to own any pain or harm I may have caused you. And I want to ask you, how I can make that right. And the most beautiful thing about that is the amends process isn't about me. And for me, my own experience and opinion is it's the first truly selfless step in Alcoholics Anonymous, because I give the other person a voice and some agency in a situation where a selfish lunatic had in some way harmed or disrupted their life. And I listen, and then I just do whatever they tell me, gratefully. And then the karmic principle of that is, if that memory comes back into the shame queue again, the end of that memory is me going to that person and owning that situation and offering whatever they need to help them heal. And so the end of that story is actually a beautiful one. And then I just brushed over the 10th step for the first 13 years of my sobriety. Very conversational. My first sponsor that I had for 11 years. just telling them things. Hey, angry today. Well, okay, go to a meeting. Sad today. Go to a meeting. Resentful. Well, you know what they say about resentment. Number one offender. Go make the coffee. And I hit a really significant emotional bottom at 13 years sober. Sponsoring 10 men. Secretary at 3 meetings. Panel once a month at Skid Row. On the board at a sober house. Wanting to die. Wanting to die. And actually, one of the men that's on the meeting right now would call me and say, hey, can I run this 10 step by you real quick? And boy, I thought I knew everything. Boy, I read the book and just thought it was hot shit. And the format in which he was doing these 10 steps was profound, and I had never heard the words before, even though I'd read the book hundreds of times. And I said, what is this? What is this you're doing? How often do you do this? And he goes, whenever it comes up. And I go, well, I know you. You're insane. I'm insane. So what are you doing these every day? And he's like, yeah, pretty much. And I go, well, how insane are you now? He goes, not really. When it happens, it's, you know, flares up. I'm an alcoholic, but it's much better. And like, again, I don't use the word miracle lightly. If so many people told me that I was an alcoholic, police, law enforcement, nuns, priests, social workers, Department of Children and Family Services, loved ones, my wife, her family, all of my friends. I can't hear you because you don't know. You don't know I can't stop. Who do I tell I can't stop my own hands from picking up alcohol? You don't get it. You don't understand. And in AA, I heard the language of the heart from other alcoholics. We get it. And you do. And you never said, this is what you have to do. You said, this is what we did. There are steps. This is my experience with the steps, like Billy read page 29 at the beginning of this meeting. Here's my story. These are the actions that I took. And so at 13 years sober, I heard the language of the heart once again. Oh, I know this man. I love this man. I love his family. He grew up like I did, but he's changed. What did you do? And it wasn't theoretical. It wasn't philosophical. His recovery is hidden in his work boots. And so he gave me this work. And it's the same way. And I went back and I redid my inventory because the format is so beautiful. But here was the difference. And I think I'm coming into the home stretch here. And God, I'm so grateful. Billy, thank you so much for asking me. There are some things that I struggled with when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, like don't drink and use no matter what. Just don't drink and use no matter what. And I was like, that was the plan yesterday, like before I came in here, like, yeah, I didn't want to drink or use no matter what. And then I came home 3 days later. So I hope the plan is not those magical combination of words of don't drink or use no matter what, because if it is, I'm going to drink because I've literally used the words, I'm not drinking today, no matter what. So it has to be something else. And what is the something else? That column of like, what should I have done instead? What should I have done instead? Oh, just be a better guy. And that was the second half of the first step, that unmanageability, is that I can wake up every day and go, I'm not going to drink today, and I'm going to be a great guy. And I'm stealing by noon. I'm lying by 3. I'm conniving by 6. So you can tell me my part all day and what I should do. And the miracle that I found at 13 years was this one little line in this fourth and 10 step format, which is this, you know, it's, I resent the cause. Is this resentment my fault? Is it possible that fill in the blank is spiritually sick, affects my SPAPs, self-esteem, pocketbook, ambition, personal relations, sex relations. Here's the money. If God were to remove the following defects of character, I would no longer have this resentment. And then I list these defects, which is the inverse of what should you have done differently? Well, yeah, I shouldn't have been angry. I shouldn't have been impatient, but I can't wish or will those things away, just like the drink. I need God's help. That is the how and the why of it. Lack of power is my dilemma. And it was just this little twist of consciousness, this little gift from a dear friend, a brother, at 13 years sober that revolutionized my sobriety. And not only just me, people, I'm in people's lives and I don't want to be a tornado. So I need this work to be for me and countless others, right? That's what it says. It'll benefit me and countless others. And I just want to end with this very quick story. I had about 20 days and I'm at Radford Hall. And if you get out to LA, you got to go to Radford. It's closed. It's just a storied clubhouse. Like my second day there, a guy fished out in a meth seizure, and then another guy punched another guy, and then a naked guy ran through from the back and a Guy Fawkes masks through the meeting out into a waiting car and drove off. And I remember thinking I had like 2 or 3 days. I'm like, this is the greatest place on earth. This is a physical manifestation of the circus that is in my head from 20 minutes before I get up till an hour after I go to sleep. Literally, this is like a dancing interpretation of my soul. And the best thing is, like, there was a getaway car. So there was another guy that heard the guy go, I'm going to streak the meeting, and the Guy Fawkes mask and the other alcoholic's like, I'll wait out front. I'll leave the car out front. Like, that's where I got sober. It's beautiful. And so all kinds of folks are there. It's just a great low bottom high, just a great piece of beautiful dysfunction. And I'm at a noon meeting. I'm doing like 3 a day. I'm in my maybe 16 days, 20 days, and it's noon. There's one guy at the meeting, and then there's an older guy there, and he's all wobbly, and there's a woman with him, and the secretary starts to me and he goes, we have any birthdays today? In LA, it's a big birthday thing. Chicago, very cold sobriety. Chicago's like, any birthdays today? And Frank, 35 years. Good job, Frank. Who wants to read chapter 5? Like, LA's like fireworks and candles and parties and so, any birthdays today? But I didn't know this. I'm new. I'm just birthdays. You got a birthday? Like, okay. Tom is celebrating 16 years sober today. Where's Bob with the cake commitment? Okay, Bob's not here. Has anybody seen Bob? Now, I don't know anything about what's happening. Where's Bob? And I'm thinking, what about Tom? What? Tom didn't drink for 16 years? What? Get out of here. Where's the cake? Any cake? We don't have a cake. Hold on, Tom. So they go in the other room and they find a half-eaten muffin with the paper bent with bite marks in it. Anybody got a candle? And I'm like, what is going on here? I got a candle. They find a candle, dusty, half-burnt. They put the half-burnt nub in the half-eaten muffin. Anybody got a lighter? What is going on? Okay, we're going to sing Tom happy birthday. Click, click, click. Happy, off key, horrible. Oh my God. This is what you get if you don't drink or do drugs for 16 years. You get a half-eaten muffin with a half-burnt candle, with three strangers squawking at you at noon, this is the prize? And he hobbles up onto the podium, and he blows that candle out, and they take his gnarled muffin into the other room, and he looks out, and he says, my name's Tom, and I'm an alcoholic, and I've been diagnosed with 6 months to live for the last 20 years. I'm a Vietnam vet. And they dumped Agent Orange on me, and it wasn't good. And I've been re-upping my gym membership every 6 months so that I can live. And God damn, I'm grateful. And I want to thank my wife, Harriet. And he looks over, and Harriet's crying. And she just was looking at him with so much love and kindness. And they just looked at each other and he said, I don't have to drink today and I don't have to use. and I love my life. And I thought, man, that's what you get. That's what you get. That's what you get. I hope you keep coming back. I'll never be able to repay Alcoholics Anonymous for what it gave me. I love you all. Thank you.